Welcome to a special edition of Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, where real men don't play. You was listening to the late, great Curtis Mayfield. And it really kind of symbolizes the theme for this show. We moving on up. We're a winner. And don't let nobody tell you that we can't make it. Don't let people's mind get in your way, because we straight from the good black dirt. Again, I'm honored to have as a special guest today a friend of mine for many years. Welcome Jason Whitlock to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner.
Uh-oh. Whitlock's back in the Country Corner with my man Bobby Glantine. Good to be here as always, bright and early on a Sunday morning. Let's take him to church.
Let the church say amen.
Yeah.
You know, Jason, a few weeks ago, there was an interview on Fox Sports 1 that involved a young white girl.
You going right there, right off the bat?
Well, you know, we want
to sit here and reminisce about wasn't I in some controversy last week? Or people were hot with you last week? Or
well, I carry my own water, and I choose my own friends. So what's hot to some people is lukewarm to me. You know,
man, you're catching a lot of hell running around with me, Bob.
Well, look here, man. I've been with Jim Brown for 30 years. I'm used to it, man. You know,
That's a hell of a compliment.
Well,
you just
really
compared me to Jim Brown. That's a hell of a compliment.
Well,
wow.
For an obvious reason. First of all, I know what it's like when you're willing to, I guess, sail your own ship, especially into the murky waters.
Sail, S-A-I-L.
Yes.
Yeah, sail your own
ship. Sail your own ship, you know, into murky waters, because being black is so multidimensional that it's hard for some people to understand that you don't know somebody till you actually know them. And then sometimes what you perceive them to be is so far afield that it's embarrassing once you get the knowledge about a person. And one of the reasons I'm so happy that you continue to, you know, associate with me on a certain level that, you know, I don't care really what people
It's hard, Bob, but I do it.
You know, actually, you ain't got no choice.
Hard for you, too, as well.
Well,
I'm sure. I don't know who's it harder on, me or you.
I don't think it's hard on either one of them, because I'm 62, you 50, what?
50.
You 50.
Don't put no extra on that. I'm 50.
So by now,
I tell the ladies I'm 40.
Yeah.
50 is the new 40.
Okay.
But anyway,
well, I'm owning that too, you know. Yeah, because I ain't on no medication, you know.
you eat right, boy.
Oh, man.
You eat right.
I drink this Kangen water. Change your water, change your life, brother. You know, it's been my experience anyway. You wasted two machines, but that's a whole nother subject matter, you know. But having said that, the woman's name is Christine Leahy.
Oh, you going back to there? All right, go
yeah,
ahead.
Because
go ahead, go ahead.
It appeared that you was Captain Sable. I'll leave the rest of it out.
Please,
you
know? Do.
Yeah.
She's a friend of mine and a coworker. Please.
So what made you step into that breach, man?
Christine Leahy is the co-host of Speak for Yourself, the Herd with Colin Cowherd. And she had an argument on air with LeVar Ball.
Right.
LeVar Ball's comments about stay in your lane or whatever, no. We're you know, her lane is the sports lane and all that it entails. And so I thought he was rude and disrespectful. And I thought she defended herself well. And then I saw people like Charlamagne the God try to analogize her to the white woman that got Emmett Till killed. And like, whoa, I know this woman. She's a coworker. She's a friend of mine. I know what's in her heart. There's nothing personal. People have been hitting me with, oh, there must be. There's nothing personal between us. She has a man, and it ain't me, and I'm not interested in going there. But I saw people. And now that I saw Charlamagne the God analogize her to the white woman that got Emmett Till killed in 1955, and that's a ridiculous and vile statement made towards someone who just doesn't have that in their heart, in their mind, in any way. You know, just the opposite, to be quite honest with you. And so, of course, it was just natural for me to defend her. I know her. She's a friend of mine. I know what's in her heart and mind. She's like any other human being. She's not perfect. I said at the time on air that, you know, LeVar did not threaten her. He was talking smack that you and I easily understood. But when you get in an argument with someone, it's instinctive that nuance goes out the window because you're in an argument. And so, are you threatening me? That's a natural ram. If you've ever had an argument with a woman or with another man, those words get said, and there was no reason for anybody to analogize her to the woman that got Emmett Till killed. And so it was just natural for me to defend. I don't pick the people I defend based on race. I pick it by right and wrong. And so I think she's a good person. I don't think LeVar Ball is a particularly bad person. He had a disrespectful moment. I've had him. Other people have had him. But, you know, I thought what Charlamagne Tha God did was irresponsible and repugnant, to be quite honest with you.
Well, my take on it starts with the optics. You know, once they went back and forth and she said that he was supposed to look her in the eye, I took offense to that because that's a man territory when you start talking like that. He's supposed to look
there you go, going too far with it. Because again,
wait a minute. When you say too far, I gave you my impression of it.
Well, I know, and I'm saying your mind pressure is going a bit too far. Having done a lot of radio and television, for him to put his hand up, and trust me, if I did it to POTUS, if I put my hand up, wouldn't look at her and said, hey, stay in your lane, you would have a right to be offended by that, and so would she.
Well, I guess that's the Neanderthal in me, because I've seen women just get so aggressive nowadays that
no question
when
about
you start
it, Bob,
talking about a man looking you in the eye, that's
Bob,
like, whoa, did you have to really say that that way?
Okay, so Bob, and this is again where I come in trying to be a mediator and say, hey, let's don't demonize anybody.
Okay.
In Inglewood, in Compton, in the hood, you're bringing a set of values there that don't play in Century City in a television studio. And so the way you're interpreting things from your experience, perhaps in communities where you're absolutely right. Again, in some of the impoverished communities we have in this country, there's a Snoop from The Wire. You know, there's some women
that
will.
That was one of my favorite shows. Yeah.
There's some women that will take you out, no different than a man.
Right.
And so I get that, but when you're in Century City at a television studio, it's a whole different playbook, a whole different set of rules. And so again, I disagreed with the demonization of either party. I thought I've been disrespectful. I've been rude. You can say that about LeVar Ball without saying he's a horrible person who should be written off. Now, there's been a lot of pushback. Oh, how can you question LeVar Ball's parenting? He's got three successful sons and blah, blah, blah. Look, man, he has made his life philosophy and parenting philosophy a part of the narrative. And so people are going to comment on it. He just did a big, long story in ESPN last week talking about his parenting and how he raised his sons. So all of that's going to be discussed. I mean, and some of the way he talked about parenting, whatever, is going to cause a lot of discussion. You know, I think LeVar is from Compton. He brings a set of values to parenting that may not sound the same to people that grew up in Beverly Hills. And so, you know, there's a bit of a culture clash. But again, I don't see LeVar Ball as some horribly negative person. I thought he was disrespectful to Christine. I said so. I don't think he threatened her. I think, you know, probably in retrospect, she probably understands that. But I got no second thoughts or regrets about defending a coworker who I know relatively well and know what's in their heart. And a person isn't remotely anti-black.
Well, you know, the perception generally is that you oftentimes in a very overwhelming way concentrate on criticizing black athletes. How far is the perception from the reality?
Well, I think when you're being criticized by people who don't follow my work, take a Charlamagne Tha God, take a D.L. Hughley, take a Michael Eric Dyson, these guys aren't watching what I do day in and day out. You know, I've been critical during this NBA Finals series of Steve Kerr. That's not going to make news on The Breakfast Club or with Charlamagne Tha God. No one's going to pay any attention to that. They only pay attention when the athlete they happen to like gets criticized. And then it's like, that's what catches their attention. But what I do on a daily basis, I'm a critic. I criticize. If people understood in a real way who seems to be most threatened by me, you know, it ain't really black people. Now, they're trying to cast it that way, but the white liberal establishment
have a problem with you.
The big problem with me, because I'm very critical of them. I think their policies sound good, but it are actually poison for black people. And that's actually what I represent, and that's actually why there's so much negative conversation because, again, everybody thinks I have these puppet strings attached to me, but it's actually a lot of the people talking about me that are black, they have white liberal puppet strings attached to them. And if you go look at my body of work, conservative, liberal, white, black, I'm just a critic. I criticize myself constantly. And so, again, I don't have an agenda, political agenda. I am, in my view, very pro-black. That's an agenda of mine because I'm black and I'm for the survival of the black race and for black people in America. And most especially, I happen to believe the black man is under attack here and being marginalized in a way that's very dangerous for us. So I am pro those things, but mostly I'm just pro fairness and following the truth. Because one, I think the truth is on our side. That's why I don't fear it. There are people out here who operate like, oh my God, if we discuss this, that's a bad look for us. They're operating out of fear. They don't really know that the truth is actually on our side. Our story makes perfect sense.
Well, you will admit that part of the problem, and this is irrespective to race, is that you're somewhat anal retentive.
Anal retentive? What?
An asshole.
Probably. Yeah. Maybe, but.
But that's a human thing. I mean, in terms of what I'm saying, you're a stickler for detail. And once you dig into something, right or wrong, you're there, 100%. And when you're right, it's really quite formidable to deal with you because you leave very little margin for error.
Well, I feel like I have a high standard.
Same thing.
And I feel like I don't ask of people anything that I don't ask of myself.
Okay.
You don't see me out campaigning, damn it, we got to eat right. We got to fix our eating, blah, blah. Now, trust me, I believe in that, but that's not part of my platform because I'm not together as it relates to my eating. Half the time I'm good, half the time I'm a shit show as it relates to eating. And so you don't see me out campaigning on that. But when it comes to, this is where I do feel like, when it comes to campaigning about self-reliance, self-sufficiency, doing things that make sense in terms of limiting the impact of racism so that you can experience some self-determination here in this country, yeah, that's my platform. I stand on that every day. That's something my parents instilled in me. We just didn't, you know, my mother, my father, they didn't see themselves as victims. They saw themselves as people who were very capable of taking care of themselves and whatever it is they created on this earth, which was me and my brother. And so, again, I tell the story a lot of times about my dad. He worked at Chrysler at a factory early in his life. And his supervisor and some of his coworkers complained that he was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X on his lunch breaks. And, you know, my father didn't complain. He's like, F this. I'm going to start my own business. Ain't nobody going to tell me what I can do on my lunch break.
But that was a good job at Chrysler.
Right. Back then. Very good job. Yeah. And it gave him, it made him go, this is crazy. I'm not working for anybody ever again because no one's going to tell me what I can and cannot read. And so that was his reaction. And, you know, that's in me in terms of I don't sit around. We spend so much time worried about what white people think rather than what we can do.
So the term racism, how do you compartmentalize it and how does it really play out in your thinking, racism?
Well, racism is real and it is significant. And it's to me, it's like the air we breathe. It's been here since the beginning of time. It'll be here long after we're gone, Bob. And so when I talk about racism, anybody is capable of being racist. And we all have biases that play out into how we interact with people and what comes out of our mouth. Now, because America has been white dominated and white run since its inception, white racism has been far more powerful than any other racism or bigotry or unfairness in this country. But as we worked our way through fighting for our rights and fighting for the limiting racism's ability to prevent us from pursuing opportunities. And as we've grown in power, and look, there's no equality. I'm not suggesting there's any equality in terms of racism's impact. But we as black people are capable and do act in a racist manner from time to time. I'll give you the example. We used our political pressure in North Carolina 10 years ago, 5, 7 years ago, whenever it was, against the Duke lacrosse players. We pressured, our black community pressured the prosecutor to take those guys to court based on some bogus evidence. And that was black racism impacting some white kids. Doesn't happen a lot, but when we have power and we're in a dominant community, we can be racist.
Excuse me, though. In that particular incident, if my memory serves correctly, they didn't go to prison, right?
Yeah, but...
So their reputations
were...
The leap to saying that we used our ability to be racist is ineffectual because there was really no long-term harm done.
Bob, you've lived way too long and you've been through way too much to suggest there was no harm done to reputations, no financial harm when you have to lawyer up for a year and a half to fight some bogus charges. There's some damage done.
Damage. I will concede that, but relative to what happens.
No.
Racist situation is far more than just what you just described happening.
Bob, you've lived way too long. Come on, man. We having a real conversation. Let's don't act like these kids went through. You go through a year and a half of stress. Have you been under indictment or have you had police scrutiny? Bob, now that's a game.
Game?
That's a game.
When you use the phrase, when I say indictment, coming up like you said in an era where, first of all, colored is on my birth certificate. So when I say that, I don't say that lightly or loosely. But let's expand past that and just say that, that didn't really fit what you were talking about.
What didn't fit what I was talking about?
Well, when you're saying that these, you use that as an example of black racism, and I'm like, compared to what? When you actually either lose your life or
okay,
you,
now hold on, Bob. Absolutely, that is true. Now you've just made my point as it relates to LeBron James. As compared to what? And this is the argument we were having last week when he tried to analogize some vandalism at his home to Emmett Till. And I was like, hold on. And so, yeah, you can. We can always play that game compared to what? Those Duke lacrosse players would say, I'd rather have someone write graffiti on my gate than go through a year and a half of public scrutiny and indictment and having a lawyer up and spend all that money in the smear and the, on my reputation. So we can always play that game. Here's what I'm saying, Bob. Racism has impact. It has more impact, far more, on black people because we've been a traditionally and still remain a white-dominated society. Get that. It's never going anywhere, is my point.
Okay.
Because if you go to your history books, go to the Bible, go to anywhere humans have existed, there's going to be discrimination and unfairness based on race in all of these societies. It's going on all over the planet. Sexism is going on all over the planet. So how do we – America has moved to a point where its laws – for the overwhelming majority of people, protect us from, in law, from the damages of race. And we get the right to vote. We get to eat where we want. We get to go to school where we want. A lot of the things that the law used to exclude us from, we fought those back, and they're there. Now, do people manipulate and pervert the law and work around that? Absolutely. So my argument isn't what where we have gone is we're arguing about hurt feelings and name calling rather than keeping the eye on the prize in terms of how does discrimination and racism really impact black people? Mass incarceration, the drug war. Those are the issues that I'm passionate about because those to me are a manifestation of white bigotry and damaging black people. Name calling is not something we should spend any time on. It just doesn't rate. Now, when a man is getting locked up for crack cocaine and another guy's getting locked up for cocaine, and because crack cocaine is pervasive in our community, somehow we came up with sentencing guidelines that put that man... Those are the types of things we should be fighting. In terms of wasting our emotional or any energy on, oh, I got called a name. And I'm not just saying, I really could care less because right. there is not you, not any white person that can call me any name that's going to stop me from doing a damn thing.
I can feel you on that. And let's circle back to LeBron for a moment. Are your feelings about LeBron as, if you had to say they were overall negative or positive?
Overall positive.
Okay.
Very positive. I like to talk approval rating. He's at about 68% for me. 68% approval. Used to be higher, but he's made some moves here, in my opinion. He's gotten caught up in this political thing. He's been trapped by the left-wing media and the left-wing movement to embrace his victimhood. So and I'm just LeBron's just not a victim.
So what is it about him in the positive that we as a people could draw from to be inspired to become more self-reliant and more self-determined?
Oh, I just think the work that he's going back to Akron in the first place, after leaving there, the man felt a calling to go back home and go to Akron. And I think a big part of that was his commitment to young people in Akron. The man has a very compassionate heart, and his work through his foundation and through trying to inspire kids through education, he's paying for kids to go to college. All of that is tremendous. His entrepreneurial spirit is tremendous. That's doing things, creating. His And it hasn't been a pretty role, but his empowerment of Maverick Carter and Rich Paul and some of his other guys, that's incredible. That's exactly what we should be doing when we acquire wealth and power. We should use it to benefit the people close to us. And for those of us that started out in the hood or wherever, we should certainly reach back and try to help the people there. So I think all of that is tremendous from LeBron James.
Now, just a quick sports note within this conversation. The game Friday night.
What about it?
Your thoughts. Was that indicative of what the series we wanted to happen, or are we going to just...
No, that was a lucky 25-point... you know, they hit 25 threes. It was a lucky 25 threes.
Now, you did an interview earlier this week, last week now, with a man by the name of Dave Rubin, the Rubin Report. And within that interview, you veered into some lanes that people, you know, typically don't see you get to go into. Can you kind of go back and kind of share with the audience what that whole interview was about? It was three different segments of it. One of them, which was your positions on gun control, which surprised a lot of people.
I mean, the interview, it was a lot of different things. You know, we talked a little bit about the LeBron James and vandalism thing. To me, my biggest takeaway from it was, and the thing I was, it flowed from the conversation we had here last week that I was glad I got to share with his audience. And I go back to, I want to continue to beat the drum that as black people, we have to recognize it's not the 1960s anymore. It's 2017. And so I'm going to circle back to what I was talking about earlier. People have won the fight for our rights. Martin Luther King and that generation won the fight for our rights. We now need to be focused on what do we do with those rights? And too much of it right now is focused on, oh, we're victims. Oh, someone called us a name. Oh, there was some microaggression. And we shouldn't, that level of victimhood has no merit with the mainstream culture. They don't care. They don't, and that's never going to be fixed. Name calling will never be fixed. In heaven, it will be. And hopefully, we'll all make it to heaven. But here, here on this planet, name calling and things like, it's never going to be fixed.
On that interview, you shared with that audience something that clearly still is a part of your everyday, I think, motivation to do what you do, and that was the death of your cousin.
I forgot about that. Yeah. We have spent over the past couple of years talking about police brutality. And, you know, I have argued, I wrote a piece a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, about how if you go all the way back to NWA, the rap group, mm-hmm. and they did the song F the Police, mm-hmm. and it was about police brutality.
Right.
And to me, police brutality is a tool that is used to send us a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Rap music at that time was dominated by conscious rappers at that time.
Okay.
It was Chuck D, it was KRS-One. Rap music at that time was elevating the consciousness of young people. And out of the West Coast, NWA comes and does one song, F the Police. And mm-hmm. I've asked young people, I go listen to Straight Outta Compton, or go listen to, I think NWA released three albums. Go listen to all their songs and show me another conscious song that they did. other than allegedly F the police. You can't find it. It was all denigration and violence and the celebration of drug dealing and violence in the black community. It was one less bitch I got to worry about. And again, I got all the music. I listened to all the music. This is why I know. They had one conscious song, and somehow now they're being celebrated as if they were Chuck D. They were the revolutionary group that spoke truth to power because they did one song. But it was really just a Trojan horse, that one song. Because what they really wanted you to do, that song was the justification for all of the filth that they were really, they're pornographers. They're rap pornographers. It's lyrical pornography, what they put out. And again, I listened to it. Still got it on my iPod. I get it. But the whole let's play the police brutality card to me was so they could usher in filthy rap, not this conscious rap that was growing and taking root. And so I go all the way to modern day, 2015, 16, 17, 2013, whatever. We have an issue, mass incarceration. Michelle Alexander wrote a tremendous book, The New Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Tremendous, outstanding, spelling out exactly what our issue is with America. Spelled it out perfectly. And if you go back into Google and look what politicians were talking about in 2013 and 14, both left and right wing politicians were talking about, man, we need to do something about mass incarceration. Michelle Alexander put it on the table in such a powerful way that our nation's politicians were like, man, we need to do something about this. The drug war and mass incarceration. Man, this was wrong, and it's doing a lot of damage to black people. What came in and took that completely off the table? Black Lives Matter and police brutality.
Well, let me, in fairness to you, move further back than Michelle Alexander to when I first, shortly after I had met you, you wrote a piece for Playboy magazine. And the substance of that piece kind of was a precursor to what Michelle Alexander came up with. So if you would, kind
her
of
book came out in 2010. In 2008, I wrote a piece for Playboy about Jim Brown's America I Can and what mass incarceration was doing to the state of California, crippling it financially, how it had empowered the prison guard union here in California, which now became the most powerful political force in California. Prison guards were funneling more money into the political system and had more influence over the state of California than teachers and doctors and prison guards.
And they were making as much money as some lawyers and judges.
Doctors, right. Prison guards. Yeah. And again, I don't want to denigrate them because some may be listening, but I'm just going to. These aren't Ivy League or even
eighth grade educated cats, man.
Yeah. Again, most power. And so, I wrote that piece in 2008. She comes out, again, her book was the thing that drove the conversation. It's a tremendous book. I'd suggest everybody read it. But our politicians were ready to address this. And then Black Lives Matter came in and made the whole country say, no, let's talk about police brutality. And undermined any possibility of, because again, once we had the riots in Baltimore, in Ferguson, maybe another city that I'm not thinking of off the top of my
head. Dust up or, little skirmishes,
Once we had the shootings in Dallas of police officers.
Now you're getting too close to home.
But again, once we had that, there was no possibility of any politician putting his name on, hey, let's address mass incarceration. Because, again, that is the issue. And I say that you brought up my cousin.
Exactly.
Because my cousin, a victim of police misconduct, tasered and killed in the rain in Indianapolis in May of 2012. We believe it was police misconduct. The police have their side of the story. You can go look it up, Google it. Me and my family, we have a different narrative and a different belief in terms of what happened. I love this kid from birth. One of the, probably the greatest kid our family produced, but he was born into the hood and he didn't really have the option to be the bookworm nerd that he should have been. And so he tried, this is a bookworm nerd, a Gomer Pyle, should have been a straight A student, should have been a doctor, a lawyer somewhere, trying to be street as a young person. And he got caught up in America's drug war and caught some cases and did some time. And so that's the engine, the drug war, the felony rap sheet. That's what puts you in position to have the police do some misconduct to you. It's the mass incarceration and the drug war that puts you in that position. It's very, very rare. And I know there are some examples, and people can throw them out, but they're very rare for the police to abuse someone that doesn't have a rap sheet. It's very rare. Now, again, I know there are some examples, but when the police have millions of interactions every year, millions upon millions of interactions with people every year, there's going to be a handful of mishaps. But the overwhelming majority of people that have police misconduct, brutality happen to them, have some type of arrest, felony arrest on their rap sheet. And so they've so criminalized the behavior in our communities that it's easy just to arrest you, and now all of a sudden you're vulnerable. Now, once you have that felony on your rap sheet, now all rules are off. And anything they do to you can be justified in a newspaper story. Well, you know, he's a two-time felon. You know, we caught him with X amount of cocaine on him 2 years ago, and he had a gun, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, we really had no choice. That's what happened to my cousin. The drug war and mass incarceration got him and put him in position to where he could be violated. And if we were to turn our attention to mass incarceration and the drug war rather than police misconduct, which, again, I explained to you previously on this show and I stand by it, the government is already motivated to stop police misconduct. It's too costly. There's always a settlement with the family. Millions of dollar settlements for Eric Garner's family, for Tamir Rice's family eventually. I don't know if it's happened yet, but eventually. The government doesn't want that. And I've tried to explain to people, we've turned the private prison industry and the prison industry into such a moneymaker that what the police force and the government, hey, can we politely take you to jail?
Where we can perpetuate the wealth that is produced through the prison industrial complex.
And so, but most of what I've been trying to convey to you and your audience and the people outside your audience is there's a game of chess being played, and we continue to play checkers.
So at the end of the day, your platform, more important, your agenda, if you have one, and how is it inspired by your cousin's untimely demise?
Well, I think it was enhanced, but you got to remember, my cousin died in 2012. I was on this path long before then. I wrote the story in Playboy in 2008. When I was in college, there was a story that came out my senior year, I think in the LA Times, when I was in college, I used to carry it around, that talked about the sentencing difference, or no, the drug use was equal between white and black people, but the drug arrest, there was this wide disparity. And so I remember reading that article when I was a senior in college and carrying it around with me for years. And the reason why, and I'm going to get, you know, too personal here, is that drugs have devastated and had a devastating impact on my family. And there are some people that I grew up with, like brothers and sisters, that drugs have done some real damage to, had some real impact on their life. And that's where my passion comes from. It comes from the people that I grew up with as best friends and running around with as kids. I saw what drugs did to them. And I can remember, I said it. I used to say it all the time. I can remember my senior year of college, I quit smoking weed. Because I was like, hey, man, this is the day before my college graduation, I remember saying, this will be the last time I smoke weed. And it was because I was like, this is a trap, man. Drugs are the trap for black people. And I got to disassociate myself from it. Now, I'm just, in all transparency, that was 1990. I probably smoked weed 6 times since, but I went a long time without ever smoking weed. And there's some women that can occasionally get me to smoke weed. I'm just keeping it 100% real. I can't be involved with drugs because I feel like it's the trap.
Now, to be so passionate about this issue, I have to ask this question. What is the extent of your political involvement? Do you vote?
No, I do not vote.
That sounds like a contradiction of sorts to me.
It's the journalist in me. And I'm not saying I'm right on this. My parents irated me for about this for years. I'm not suggesting it for other people. I'm a journalist. At the end of the day, that's my identity is caught up in being a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to remain objective. And so I've never wanted to have my point of view clouded by people's, he voted for so-and-so, or he's a Republican, or he's a Democrat, so therefore we can dismiss his opinion. And so that's one part of it. And then the second part of it is, I can't stand politicians. I really can't. I don't trust them. I don't think they're honest. I think they've been so compromised that, you know, I just don't like them. You know, I hate to admit this because it'll sound like I have a bias, which I probably do. You know, Obama's probably the first politician that I halfway liked. And some people say, oh, that's just because he's black. And there's probably some truth to that. I never liked golf until Tiger Woods.
Mm.
I'll be honest with you. And it's, you know, it's not that I'm particularly proud of it, or maybe I am. I never voted for Obama because I just don't involve myself in politics.
Leadership and politicians, you know, kind of go hand in hand. What, in your estimation, if you had to score black leadership 2017, what would that mark look like?
Well, I'm not even sure if we have leadership at this time. We certainly don't have what we had with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and we certainly don't have what we had at the 60s. We don't even at this point even have what we had in the 70s and 80s in terms of Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition and things like that. I would be struggle to say who our leader is. Twitter. literally. And, you know, there's a white dude at the New York Daily News pretending to be black that thinks he's a leader, Deshaun King guy. It would be hard for me. Well, again, and it's crazy to say, we just had a black president. But again, he operated as I always thought he would, as a politician. He did not operate as a black president. He operated as a politician and as a president. And that was the right role for him. So I don't consider Obama at this point any part of black leadership. So, you know, I don't know. What, help me out here. Who is, do we have, who would you point to as our leadership?
I'm drawing a blank because my measurement of leadership is if you can't feed people, you can't lead people. So my tilt would be more toward the captains of industry, people that create opportunities and solve problems. And I don't see anybody right now on the political front that's doing either one of those, solving any problems or creating any commerce in our communities. Yeah. Other than the person you don't want me to mention.
Who?
Wendell Stimson.
Oh. Well, that's fine. And, you know, but in terms of national leadership and things like, I don't see it. I see us being led around black leadership in this moment, again, because the NAACP isn't strong. Black
are they still in operation?
Yes, they are still in operation. I think I'm still a member. Black leadership right now, it's social media. And social media is not controlled by us. And so, you know, black leadership right now is the white liberal movement. That's what black leadership is.
So what should we, as a identifiable group of people, be concentrating on, in your estimation? I'm talking about black folks. What should we be, you know, primarily focused on in terms of addressing the social and economic problems that we face with in 2017?
What should we be focused on? We should be, first and foremost, we've gone very secular. And we think that there's some power in atheists, being an atheist. And it's a gigantic mistake. If we do not, and this is where Michelle Alexander, one of my idols, if she has returned to the church, if you go read up on what she has been involved in, I think she just joined some seminary, and she has acknowledged that our issues cannot be addressed until we address our spirituality, until there's a return to the church and getting right with God and getting our spiritual house in order, there's no solution. Because that's got to be at the center of a foundation, because then our next step would be repairing the black family. Because if we don't do that, if the right now we are so out of balance, and I want to be careful here, but we are so out of balance in terms of there's supposed to be a man-woman dynamic in a culture that's equal. Right now, our culture is being run by women completely. And that's through no fault of their own. They're stepping up because, in my view, we as black men have failed. And we chase money and everything except what we're supposed to be doing. So they have stepped up. But unless we go back to, and again, people will say, well, if you go back to Martin Luther King in his days, there was no equality. Yes, I believe there was equality. And I'm not talking about returning to a time where the woman stayed behind the scenes or the woman stayed at home and the men were out front. I'm just talking about some equality, because right now our leadership is needs a little dose of masculinity and a little bit. I want to say this without, I don't mean to be offensive, but this morning I was looking at, you know, people think or say or write, or studies have said that men and women react to different things differently. That there's more of an emotional component to women and less of one for men. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I don't mean that in any negative way. I don't mean one side is superior, one side. But again, when I look at what's going on with us and we lose our mind, oh my God, a white person called us a name. And we just lose our mind. And we don't have the ability. It's a very emotional, feelings-based reaction. And I come from a very non-emotional, non-feelings-based perspective. People I love can hurt my feelings. People I don't know, no dice. People I don't like or respect, no dice. They have no control over my feelings. I'm not handing over my feelings and my emotions to another group of people. No how, no way. And I look, it's like we're trying to have a civil feelings movement. We had a civil rights movement.
Civil rights movement.
We wanted our rights. We gonna vote. We gonna work where we want. We gonna live where we want. Those are rights. We now are in this feelings. We're having a civil feelings. Mm. Don't talk about me. Oh my God, you called me a name. I got to act all emotional. And again, this is what, because people have asked, I saw, you know, I engaged on the message board that is associated with this, and mm-hmm. you're just gonna let white people call you any name and blah blah. You got, man, I could care less what they called me. I care about what I can do to empower myself and empower the people around me.
So, will you ever get married and have kids?
Man, I'm 50.
I didn't ask you how old you were.
It's look, and again, when I say there's no advice that I'm giving that doesn't apply to me. And so when I say return to our spiritual base, get our spirituality in order, I'm talking about myself. And when I say get the family together, I'm talking about myself. These are things I need to do. I'm trying, but at this point, it's hard, man. When you get to be 50 and you've been living your way most of the time, the way you want, it's hard. But would I like to? Yes. But, you know, I want to go back to finish out this point because I want to be very clear here. Spiritual, family, and then we have to take control of our own destiny and get out of the mindset that the only way we get ahead as black people is if white people improve. There's nobody else on the planet that thinks that way, that the improvement of someone else is going to improve you.
So what does that include? In addition to the spirituality and stuff, we mentioned politics. What are the other components of reconstructing a viable and prosperous black existence here in America?
Well, again, if the spiritual's in order, you're going to start to see the God in yourself. And you're going to start to realize how important you are, not how important they are. That's the first battle we have to fight in the mind, that Bob Glanton is the most important person to the success or failure of Bob Glanton. Same with me. We right now are in the mindset that there are magical white people who have more say-so over your self-determination than you do. And it's just wrong. It's inaccurate. And it's a death sentence. If we sit around and wait for white people to cure themselves of the bias that they're superior, it's going to be a long wait. will never see. Will never. None of us will ever live long. Everybody that hears my voice right now, neither you nor your grandkids will live long enough to see that day. Now, if we get to heaven, we'll see it. But here on this planet, it's never been in existence. There are, look, and I'm talking about, and I don't want to just apply that to white people. Same for us as black people. We have a bias towards blackness. We do. And we act like that if we were in control, we would act so righteously and we would do all the right things. And there's nowhere in any history book or in any Bible or any Quran that says that that's true, that that's ever been in existence. People, regardless of color, are unfair. It's just a fact. Eve and the apple and Adam, unfairness was introduced into the world and it's never going anywhere. What you want from your government is to, as best they can, ensure your rights. And then you have to take responsibility for making sure unfairness doesn't stop you from succeeding.
So in terms of quote unquote community, is there a social and economic responsibility for people who have had a measure of success to contribute not just necessarily money, but their time and their expertise to improve the places that they came from?
I personally think so. I don't judge people that don't think so. Because again, we are, black people, we're so anti-black mentally right now that it's hard for us to come together and do anything. Because every other ethnic group faced some form of discrimination, perhaps not to the level that we did and do, but they faced discrimination. And their mentality was, oh, we're going to build this Italian community, exchange our money within the Italian community. Oh, we're going to build this Irish community, exchange our money. We're going to build this Jewish community, exchange our money. We're going to blah, blah, blah. We are the only people that keep sitting out there saying, what's white people going to do? Instead of like, let's do our own thing and take care of ourselves. We don't trust each other enough. We are afraid to hold each other accountable enough to even do that. We are the ones that have allowed record companies to pay us, here's X number of dollars if you'll make some music denigrating black people and talking about your women, your kids, talk about killing each other. Here's a check. Make denigration music that destroys the image of the black man. Here's a check. I haven't seen any other community do it. I don't know a genre of white music that denigrates white people. Do you?
When you put it in that construct, I'm struggling to find
one. Have you seen some Irish people? I never hesitate to kill another Irish person.
No.
Have you seen a Jewish person? I hate Jews. I'm a Nazi. We have a black female rapper that said, I hate niggas. I'm a Nazi. And no one objected. Dej Loaf, very popular. Everybody loved her. It's on some very popular song that was played all over the radio. We have allowed that. And so it's very hard for us to work together. And when you do, I'm going to personalize it because it'll sound like I'm making myself out a victim. But when you have a different mindset than the overwhelming majority, the people think, oh, the liberal thing is the end-all, be-all. When you reject that and come to black people and say, nah, I think there's a different route, you get excoriated, man. Again, me coming here consistently and trying to engage in this conversation, people think I'm doing it for my own benefit. Which perhaps to some degree there is some benefit that I want out of this. And the benefit is I'm trying to reach back and say, here's, man, here's how I made it. When I go evaluate the other people that have made it, these are the techniques, tools, strategy that they use to get ahead. They have Oprah Winfrey didn't sit around and say, oh, I'm going to make it big once white people love me. It just didn't happen. And so, again, I get vilified for coming here and anywhere. And just trying to say, hey, I think there's a different route we should try. We have tried this route that we're on. I think King got assassinated in 1968.
Yeah.
So it's been 50 years.
Yeah.
Right. 50 years. We've been trying the, oh, I'm a victim, and if white people would ever just cure themselves of racism, I could actually do something. We've tried that. And how's it working for us? Not well.
We're on the edge of extinction. I'd like to make a quick commentary, and that is whatever your motivations are outside of the ones that I'm in touch with, by coming into this community at this particular point in time, I find it refreshing and personally encouraging simply because of where we are. There's so much economic activity going on in and around this area without our participation, and to have a person come into this community right now with a vision of sorts that's consistent with doing the kind of things and illuminating the issues from a proactive point of view is essential. And I hope it starts a fire here, because if it doesn't, we'll be out here in another 5 years when all of the development around this area is completed, marching and protesting, when we're at that critical point where either we get in this game are we going to be left out of it? And it's just amazing, man. I was riding around yesterday, and I'm seeing people outside of my race investing in this community heavily. And it's because you can't make this you can't make any more real estate. And from downtown to the airport, man, it's amazing what's going on right now. And it will take people who have, as you have demonstrated, an ability to, you know, see what you do and how in this, and especially in mass communications right now, that's where instead of the utilization of that communication mechanism to uplift people and at least enlighten them as to the possibilities, is used to deconstruct our community. So I'm going to salute you once again just because you have been consistent about coming in here, and it's very timely. And I again want to just commend you for doing that, brother, point blank.
Appreciate it, but, you know, I have my own motivations or whatever. You know, I'm far from
altruistic.
Not sacrificing. I'm not making any huge sacrifice, Bob.
Well, yeah, maybe in
it
your
ain't
estimation.
That far of a drive.
Yeah. Well,
place is nice.
You know, and like I say, the upside of it is it allows us to at least look at some things that we typically don't talk about, and that's important, you know. And as we begin to, you know, wrap up this particular session, any final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I'm just going to reiterate what I've already said, I think, is just we have to think about, open our minds, just consider. I'm not saying you have to do it. Just consider a different approach. You know what's worked well for LeBron James and people are celebrating? Free agency. And you know what? Things ain't going the way in Cleveland that I want them to go, so I'm going to pick up and move to Miami. Worked out well for Kevin Durant so far. Free agency. And we, and again, I'm about to get political, which, again, I'm really not. But mentally, we need to exercise some free agency and really analyze, is this liberal thing that we have now concluded liberal means pro-black. Does it really? And does conservative really mean anti-black? We should ask ourselves that question and really look. And I keep this and stay in the sports lane on this in terms of if you look at football, it's the most conservative sport we have going right now. And compare that to Hollywood, the most liberal thing we got going right now. And look and see where we're having success at the highest rate. Is it football or is it Hollywood? And just go, these conservatives that are, oh, they're so terrible and they just hate black people. They're running an industry in the NFL and even in college football that has done more for black men than Hollywood would ever hope to accomplish in 1,000 years. In terms of taking someone like me through football, out of my community, moved me to a college campus, allowed me, I would have never gone to college without football and without football coaches, and allowed me to expand my horizons and build a career. So many, just think of how many black boys you know that have used football, not just to make it to the NFL, but just improve their life and enhance their life and enhance their family's life. And just that's a conservative sport. And we, the media, the left-wing media has convinced you that the NFL and football are racist and anti-black. And 70% of the NFL is black. These young men are making millions of dollars, created more black millionaires, I believe, than any other industry. But football is racist, and the conservatives running football are racist and anti-black. Meanwhile, Hollywood, which we complain about every year, blacks can't get no parts, blah, 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 has a handful of token stars. Mm-hmm. Hollywood ain't 70% black.
Nowhere close to that, no.
Run by liberals, but they're the good guys. They got our best interests. Love them to death. Couldn't make it without them. Open your mind to free agency. It works.
You know, that's a great segue for my closing remarks today. This week in Columbia, South Carolina, from Thursday to Saturday, the National Association of Minority Contractors will be convening. And one of the themes is the business of sports and entertainment. I've constantly mentioned the name of Wendell Stemmler because he's the LeBron James of construction management. More importantly, as Jason just mentioned, the NFL has right now on the table several projects, one of which is the Hall of Fame renovation that's going to involve over $1 billion worth of economic activity. Jerry Jones, who's having a program that he's dealing with in terms of expanding his project down in the Dallas area. And then the new stadium coming online in Las Vegas. And Jerry Jones is the kind of man that is open to the possibilities. One of the things that we didn't get a chance to talk about today that hopefully we'll talk about later is the fact that you have suggested that that would be a great place for Colin Kaepernick. So just very quickly, where were you going to go with that notion that that might be a good spot for Colin Kaepernick?
Well, I just think Kaepernick needs to play on a team that's their brand is bigger than his controversy. And the Cowboys brand is so massive and so big, they're America's team, it would swallow up the Colin Kaepernick controversy. Dak Prescott would swallow up the Colin Kaepernick controversy. Kaepernick's no threat to unseat Dak Prescott. Kaepernick wouldn't go into that locker room and the players would rally around Kaepernick. No, they're going to rally around Dak Prescott. Jerry Jones, if you look at his history, and he's another one of these conservative Trump voting bigoted NFL owners who somehow gave Greg Hardy and so many other black players a second and third chance when no one else would touch them. He stood by Michael Irvin. Nate knew a bunch of players. And you can say, oh, that's because they won him Super Bowls, or, oh, that's because he wants to win games. Whatever the motivation is, I don't care. He did it. Because, again, what's the motivation in Hollywood? And they didn't do it.
Great.
So, again, I think Jerry Jones has the balls to take on Kaepernick. If it'll help his team win, he'll take on Kaepernick. I think he'll tell the people in Texas, this is my guy.
Back off. Yeah.
If I can stand by Greg Hardy, I can certainly stand by Colin Kaepernick. So I would not be surprised if Jerry Jones and the Cowboys made that move. Dallas needs a backup quarterback, and he's shown a proven history of not just some college campus theory about what he'll do for black athletes or black people. He got the receipts for what he's done. And so wouldn't surprise me if he made a move here with Kaepernick.
Well, again, Jason, I want to thank you for continuing the string, in my opinion, of making good on my promise that every week we would present models of possibility and best practices. So tune into our regular show on Tuesday, 5:30 p.m. PST, as we continue down this particular road that we're traveling on. I want to thank Porter for once again providing a comfortable atmosphere for us to do what we do. And as always, thank you for letting me be myself again. We out of here.